From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a young woman from the Buffalo area got into some trouble, fell into a life of alcoholism. Her name is Caitlin. We're withholding her last name at her request, and you're going to meet her in a moment. But first, some of her background. Caitlin was drinking, as she calls herself, kind of a garden variety alcoholic, and for a time living out of her car. And a man named Kenneth White saw his opportunity. He promised her something better. She had no idea that she was being lured into a life of human trafficking. And you might have seen Caitlin's story in a special report from WROC-TV's Adam Chodak earlier this month. She's telling her story because she hopes it can help others and maybe even save lives. And if you've been skeptical that human trafficking is happening around here, Caitlin's story is the classic case of how it happens. And it's also a remarkable story of someone who broke free and has taken her life back. We asked Caitlin to come in and tell her story at length, and she is one of my guests for the hour. And Caitlin, I just have to say, I admire you so much. I'm glad to see you doing well, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
And Adam Chodak is here, WROC-TV anchor and managing editor. And I want to just start by asking you how you were sort of keyed into the story. How did this come about?
So about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a man arrested in the Rochester area, Thomas Kramer, and he was accused at that time of trafficking several women. And we were given the address of where he lived and all that. So I went as a reporter out to the address. It was an apartment in an apartment complex in Brighton. I passed by it dozens of times. And it struck me at how normal it all looked. And as I looked into it, I realized that the story of these women was much different than what I had imagined. So I wondered if my perception was common, my misperception in this case was common. And I think it was. And so the more I looked into it, the more intrigued I was by what was happening, because I realized how extensive it was and how many victims there are. So over the 3 years, I kept looking at these stories as they cropped up after Kramer's, and I kept thinking, boy, this is a story. So I reached out to Barbara Burns over at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Western New York, and she was extremely helpful. And at first I thought to myself, we're going to be talking to some survivors anonymously. Maybe we'll have to change their voice, black out their face, whatever it is. And as we progressed, this was a 5-month project. Barbara and I, we kept trying to figure out how to coordinate this. And then Caitlin and Stephanie so bravely stepped forward, and they wanted to share their story because they want to help. And so when we met them in Buffalo a few weeks ago, they both sat there and just opened up and allowed me to share their story and hopefully clear up the misperception that's out there that I once held.
Well, I mean, think about it. There's no way to know for sure, but if we could just go back, say, 3 years, and you and I are sitting here, and somebody asked you and me, what's the reality of human trafficking? I don't even know what I would have said.
Well, first of all, the thing that I learned is human trafficking is an umbrella term for a lot of, and really what you're talking about is enslaving people, but sex trafficking is a sub part of that. And so sex trafficking is really just turning a woman, usually in her teens, into a prostitute.
But you know, for me, I think 3 years ago, I don't think I would have, it's not that I wouldn't have believed it. It's that it's hard to get your head around because, you know, and we're going to talk to Caitlin about this, and I'm sure she's been asked before. People will say, well, just run away, just break free. And there's so much mental control, and there's physical violence and danger. There might be trouble at home or in various cases. But I think I would not have been able to get my head around it. And I'm looking at him at some of the numbers from the National Human Trafficking Resource Center. In 2016, human trafficking in the United States rose 35% from the previous year alone. More than 31,600 total cases of human trafficking have been reported to their hotline in the last 8 years. And that's just what's been reported, because what we know now is there are plenty more cases out there that are not reported, right?
Absolutely. And Caitlin can speak to that even better than I, because she knows a lot of the women that she'll talk about. She traveled the country. The other surprising part, and then I'll stop, but the other surprising part to me is the population that makes up the survivors. I, again, 3-4 years ago, would have guessed that it would have been women that were pulled in from out of the country or various big urban centers.
Yep.
And that could not be farther from the truth.
I'm looking at some of the other numbers that we have. This is from equalitynow.org. Women and girls do make up 98% of sex trafficking victims, and an estimated 80% of all trafficked persons are used and abused as essentially sex slaves. So, Caitlin, for you, you grew up in the Buffalo area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just generally speaking, how would you describe your upbringing, family situation? It was pretty positive?
Extremely. I went to good Catholic schools. I had two loving parents who gave me everything I could ever have wanted for. And the only difference between me and any other suburbanite was I was born with the hereditary disease of alcoholism, which is where that took me to ended up being trafficked.
All right. So you had this sort of you called a happy childhood?
Extremely.
Okay. A good childhood in Western New York. But when did you remember drinking for the first time?
I was 14. Mm-hmm. Actually, I remember I drank alcoholically from the very first time I drank. I drank to excess and to get drunk. That was my only sole purpose of ever drinking was to get drunk.
And so it happened very quickly for you from that age of 14 when you started drinking. I mean, do you remember, did your parents know about it? Did they try to stop you? What was going on?
They did try and stop me, and it got to the point where I would run away from home just so I could drink. They put an ankle bracelet on me, and I cut it off and ran away so I could drink. There was nothing that was going to stop me from consuming or obtaining alcohol.
How old were you when they put the ankle bracelet on you?
16.
16. Did you feel your life out of control at that point, or did you think, you know, this is, I can control this? You know, what was going on through your mind?
I don't think I had the mental capacity as a young teenager to have the foresight into, you know, what the future was going to hold or what this was going to, how it was going to affect my future. The only obsession I had, that was, and I will call it, it is an obsession of the mind and body, was to drink. And there would be bad circumstances or something bad would happen. And I was actually sexually assaulted the very first time I drank. I was sexually assaulted at 14 at a house party. And that wasn't an indicator of, well, maybe this is bad. I couldn't wait to do it again. Not get sexually assaulted, of course, but,
of course, yeah.
You know, drink, you know, I couldn't wait to drink again because a lot of alcoholics have this common feeling of never fitting in or never really belonging. And the alcohol really is a symptom.
And so eventually you end up reading an Adams report, kind of living out of your car.
I did. I actually got a DWI and my family was pretty much done with me at this point. I was lucky I still had a car even actually. And I'd gotten a DWI, and the time had lapsed. Nobody would bail me out of jail. And I got out, and I got my vehicle and had no money and nowhere to go. And I was like, well, what do I do now, you know?
How old were you?
I was 18.
18 years old. And when you say your family was kind of done with you, they had tried to work with you on alcoholism and you had kind of kept pushing them away. Is that how you would describe it?
I would. My dad is actually a recovered alcoholic, and I use the word recovered with my father, even though I believe you're always in a process of recovering.
Okay.
But my father has multiple decades of sobriety, and he is very familiar within the program of, you know, how you treat alcoholism. He is a forensic drug and alcohol psych nurse, and he knows that I'm actually lucky. He gave me the dignity of my own experience is what I like to call it. There's nothing you can say to somebody who wants to get help for the treatment of their addiction or disease, you know, or alcoholism. They have to want it themselves, and pain is a generally a pretty big motivator for that. So it didn't matter. He could have talked to me till he was blue in the face. My mother was they had actually separated by this point, and my mother was more focused on, you know, everything else going on in her life from her pending divorce. But my father was there for me always to talk and have an open door. But he always said, don't call me drunk. Call me before you drink. And I would always call him drunk. So
We're talking to Caitlin, withholding her last name at her request. She is a human trafficking survivor. And you might have seen Caitlin and another woman's story, Stephanie, told recently by Adam Chodak and WROC TV in a special report, a months-long investigation into human trafficking in Western New York. And if you want to check out Adam's work there, producer Megan Mack and I will link to it on our Twitter account. So at Evan Dawson and at MMackMedia. So you can check that out, because I know Adam, as we start to get into Caitlin's story, Caitlin is one of two women who were willing to sit down and tell you these stories that in many ways sounded, there were a lot of similarities, right?
Yeah, a lot of parallels. Obviously, Caitlin, as she just described, had an addiction to alcohol. Stephanie had an addiction to heroin, and they're both very vulnerable. And I think that's the key in this story. The larger story is the vulnerability and these predators. these sex traffickers seek that out and they take advantage of that. And when you talk to both Stephanie and Caitlin, the steps, even though the time frame is much different, the steps were very similar. And then, of course, we had the big surprise to me when we were talking is that they were both trafficked by the same person, Kenneth White.
All right. And we'll tell you what's going on with him coming up here. In fact, let's go back to you're 18 years old. You were living out of your car. When did you meet Kenneth White? When did that all that happen?
A year later, I had been surviving on the street.
Okay.
Through any means possible at that point. And I was getting very tired. I was couch surfing, kind of just making friends with other drinking buddies and stuff like that. Dating guys who would let me sleep on the couch for a while, then get sick of my attitude and behaviors and my literally unpredictable behavior that would come from drinking. Because I might just drink and just pass out and everything would be fine. Or I might get drunk and take your car. And that did happen once. I did take my boyfriend's car without his permission.
And so you were surviving this way at the age of 19. I guess getting money wherever you can? Were you trying to work at all?
No. Okay. Not whatsoever. I had actually found a sugar daddy, but I didn't know it was a sugar daddy at the time. It was an older gentleman who was just nice to me and, would, see me once a week, give me a couple $100 in my pocket, and obviously have sex with me. And I was so faded in my mental capacity that it really didn't strike me as that was a sugar daddy.
Okay.
But I guess the definition by that, that's what it would be.
And so how did Kenneth White come into the picture here?
I was coming out of a liquor store on a very bad neighborhood in Buffalo. And he basically came at me and said, hey, I could, buy you nice clothes. You wouldn't have to worry about anything. I got in the car.
He came right up to you.
He came right up
out of the blue and just started talking to you.
Well, he was with a friend, a mutual friend that I had known, because I also used to smoke marijuana. And I used to smoke marijuana with the friend that he was with.
Okay.
And he offered to let me come in his car and smoke some marijuana with him. And I said, sure, why not? It's free, And this is how he approached me. And I was so against it at first. I said, no, you know what? Just drop me off. Just drop me back off to my car. I don't want any part of this. And as about a week or two went by, he said, take my number anyway. And I did, actually. I did take the number. And a week or two went by, and I'm sitting in the car, and I have nowhere to go. I have no money. I have no gas. Sugar Daddy's not answering. And out of pure desperation, for lack of a better word, I picked up the phone and I called him. And within 2 days, I was in New York City.
Did he come pick you up?
He did.
He picked you up in Buffalo. What did he tell you and what do you remember thinking? Did you think, okay, I'm desperate, but this guy seems like a good guy. He's promising. Or in the back of your mind, were you worried? What was going on?
I was worried, but he was a very smooth talker. He was very attractive. He had a lot of charisma. He seemed intelligent. And he was for as horrible a person as he was an extremely intelligent individual. He gave me directions on this is what you're going to do. This is how you're going to sell yourself.
Whoa. Right away. All right. So he picks you up in Buffalo and you go down with him to New York City.
Correct.
And in your mind, you're thinking, well, I don't have a home, so that's okay?
Yep.
Okay. And was it that first conversation or was it after a couple of days? How quickly was he talking about this?
It was the next day.
The next day. And you was this a surprise to you or did what
I knew his no I knew his intentions because of what he had previously said to me in the car, and I had not exactly been so much of an angel that I won't have sex with somebody if it gives me a roof over my head or food in my belly. So it was kind of just like, all right, well, I'll just go along with this. And all the promises he was making,
like what?
Obviously about, I could get you clothes and let's go get your hair and nails done. He did get my hair and nails done right away. What kind of car do you want to be driving? Where do you want to be living in 10 years? He projected a long-term means to the end to the means, if you know what mm-hmm. I mean. Do this for 5 years and you will be set the rest of your life.
That's what he was telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you believe him?
I did. And I will say, obviously, my judgment was clouded with the alcoholism. And it was looking forward in this direction. Okay, this is, basically what I was doing anyways, for lack of a better word, was already sleeping with guys just for a place to live. So he's telling me all these things. And he was coming through on his promises at first, the going to buy me clothes. And what he was really doing was grooming me so he could sell me. I'm thinking he's just a nice guy. Oh, I'm getting my hair done. I'm getting my nails done. He's, you know, buying me nice clothes and shoes and even bought me some jewelry. But what he was really doing was grooming me to so that I was marketable.
You're 19 years old.
Correct.
Your family back in the Buffalo area in Western New York has no idea you're gone at this point, right?
No clue. We did not really have any contact, or I would call home once a couple months.
All right. So, again, this is the picture Caitlin is painting here. You know, Adam, from your discussion with U.S. attorneys and the work on this, you know, she's 19. It's often teenagers. It can be very young teenagers, but this is how they sort of vanish from their family. And here's Caitlin gone to New York City. Her family had no idea. This is pretty typical from what we understand, yes?
Yeah, and Caitlin said it best in the piece. We sometimes think it's a child taken from a Target or someone shipped in from another country, but often we really have to think about this as a runaway or a similar situation, an abusive relationship, sometimes battered women. Again, these are all Caitlin's words. And so what was interesting is prostitution is illegal. I have to say my perception of it changed a little. And while there are certainly people out there committing crimes in this arena, at the same time, there has to be an understanding. And this comes from the U.S. Attorney's Office. This is not me necessarily saying this. I believe them. I understand their position. There has to be an understanding that there are victims in this case. And even though their acts may be considered illegal, there has to be a consideration that they are being forced to do these things.
This is such an important point because, you know, Caitlin is, I'm sure, going to talk about this. It's one of the ways that victims are kind of held in the captivity they are, because they're technically, you know, they're treated like criminals, or sometimes society treats them like criminals. We're going to get there in a moment here. I want people to understand exactly sort of where you were living. Were you living with Kenneth White?
I was living in hotels.
In hotels?
All around the country.
Wherever he would take you?
Correct.
Okay. And he would pay and you'd go with him.
He would give me the money. He never wanted his name linked to anything. He would never put his name on a room.
Okay.
If we flew, I flew by myself, et cetera. So he thought he was being smart by not ever having his name linked to mine, especially on a hotel room, because if you get busted and there's a sting, well, then the police have his name, because then his name's on the room. So this is the things he thought he was doing to keep himself safe.
All right. So almost immediately you were living out of hotels?
Oh, right away.
Okay. Were you meeting any other women? Did this look to you like this was a man with an operation of multiple victims or multiple young women, or did you only, you know, have contact with Kenna?
Well, at first I was the first, and then there were more. He did, a few days after I'd been in New York City, he sent for another girl to come fly up, and I met her, and she and I kind of bonded. We liked each other. She and I kind of bonded because I'm literally on the street on like 45th and 10th in New York City on the West Side, where we would work from 11 p.m. till 2 a.m. And then we would go over to the East Side on Lexington and 30th, where we all the girls would work from 3 a.m. on to like 7 a.m. I'd be so embarrassed. I'd be on the street in almost nothing. And you see the school buses coming out and the children looking at you. And that's actually the only time I felt shame. I felt safe under the protection of nighttime, but in the daytime, it was apparent how wrong it was. People were going to work in their business suits and they're looking at you and they know who you are. They know what you're doing.
Hmm. How did he arrange for where you were supposed to be? What was that kind of setup like with Kenneth White?
His uncle is actually a huge pimp, very well known across the country. And his uncle actually groomed him as to where to go, where to take the girls. And then apparently it's a whole entire network. All the pimps, actually, they all know each other. They talk. They are, you know, you know whose girls are who's on the street, especially in New York.
And you would end up, most of your work, so to speak, was in hotels?
No, I was walking the street, getting into cars. Then this was before the time of online advertising.
Yeah.
There was like the Village Voice and Art Voice magazines where you could put paper advertisements in. But this was all started before the huge blow up of like Craigslist and Backpage. So.
And again, we're talking to Caitlin about her work as a victim of human sex trafficking. Some of this is going to be a little grim, maybe difficult. And Caitlin, of course, the disclaimer that I gave her before the hour, and I'll say it again now. There's nothing that you have to talk about or have to answer, obviously. But, you know, when you are, as you said, you would go to work from 11 to 2 and then from 3 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be, you know, what did you call? Did you call them clients? You know, were you being dropped off? Were you being picked up? Was the sex happening in cars? What was the setting like?
You would just call them clients. Nowadays, they call them hobbyists. That's the term they use nowadays. Gentlemen like to refer to themselves as hobbyists. It's their hobby to buy women. And it does disgust me. It's not that there's anything I don't want to talk about. And I just want to have my own little disclaimer. It's not that anything I say, like, I don't want to come off as, like, proud of anything
no,
I've done.
No, I understand.
You know, it's important to stick to the facts, because if you don't stick to the absolute direct and narrow facts, people aren't going to really understand. But what Kenneth White did was make this seem so normal, because I was discussing it with Adam before. It literally is like a subculture of people. And there's so many girls that I've seen come and go throughout the years. That was the only thing with Kenneth White. He never let me go. I don't know why. I don't know if it was because I was the first, and I did try and leave several times, but he would let other girls come and go. If they didn't want to be there, he would say, fine, he would get them a bus ticket, send them home. But for some reason, he never, ever tried to let me go.
Did you tell him you wanted to go?
Yeah.
Oh,
I would cry to him. I want to go home. I want to go home. And he would, he knew how to play the game. He knew that, when I was feeling weak, he would use sex, he would use expensive gifts, things like that, to make it seem like it's worth it for staying. And I would say, I want to go, but I really had nowhere to go. I talked about this in my other interview. A pimp and prostitute relationship, and if you want to call it a relationship, if that, it very closely mirrors a domestic violence relationship, where they come in, they isolate you. You have no resources for anything whatsoever. They restrict any money you may have or be holding. And I tried to stash money before, and I don't know how he always found it. He must have checked everything whenever I wasn't in the room. He was able to find money. I hid in the bottom of sneakers. And it was always like, I'm going to save just enough to get away. And then there were times where I did get away. I went to a domestic violence shelter, and he somehow found me. I would come out to go to an appointment for Section 8 to try and get an apartment on my own, and he would be parked on the street and physically bring me back into the car.
What were those moments like?
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. He used physical force and intimidation on a regular basis. And I said in my earlier report, I documented everything, though. I went to the hospital, and they knew who I was. They knew what I was doing. And they were, frankly, getting sick of seeing me. I've been in hospitals all over the country because he assaulted me hundreds of times and put me in the hospital over 20 times for all those assaults.
Did you think he was going to kill you?
Yeah, there was times I did. I have a scar right here on my hand from when he held a knife to my throat. And not thinking about anything, I grabbed the knife with my hand and pulled it away from my throat. And I actually had to go to the hospital and get stitches for that blade mark across my hand.
Most of the time, when he was physically violent, did he hit you? Did he do other things?
Punched, kicked, stomped. I would go to the hospital. I would have Timberland boot prints all over me, and they could see clearly I had been trampled because you could see the imprint of the boot prints.
Did he, when you had finally sort of recovered as best you could from those, did he then say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get angry? Did he try to smooth talk you into staying, or was it more intimidation?
He never said he was sorry, ever. He would turn it around, gaslight the girls, and make you believe that it was your fault that you got hit. If I hadn't have done this, I wouldn't have gotten that. And he really was good at drilling that mentality into you.
But did you believe it?
At the time, I did. I did. I knew, and I would blame myself for being there. I would say, this is my fault. You know, I knew better. And it really is almost like a form of mental illness.
Oh, boy. So this goes on for, again, 2005 is when you were picked up, right?
Correct.
This goes on for 8 years?
Correct.
Was there...
I'm sorry, 2006. My apologies.
Okay.
It was January, so it had just turned 2006.
Was there ever a time where you did think that you were going to get away permanently. But before this all ends, and in our second half hour, we're going to talk about what happened with Kenneth White now and lessons learned going forward. But was there ever a moment where you really thought, this is going to be it, I'm going to get away? You said there were moments where you almost got mm-hmm. your own apartment and he would find you. Were there yeah. moments that you were away for even a day, 3 days, a week from him?
There was a time, I think the longest I got away from him was 5 days. And I actually ran away to another city, to Atlantic City, because I was so scared of staying in the same city. I ran away to Atlantic City, and I was going to just work there as a prostitute and get, you know, save my money, et cetera. And he, I don't know how, but he has friends in Atlantic City. And another pimp actually picked me up and put me in a closet for 2 days until I agreed to go home.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. And you talk about, you know, going to work in Atlantic City as a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a victim here. You've been victimized now at this point for years, and you've been doing work that Kenneth White forced you to do. Can you tell me the sense that you have, Caitlin, in that situation, if you ever thought, well, who's going to believe me, or I'm the one who's done something wrong, or am I going to be treated as a criminal?
Exactly. Well, I was raped by a police officer in New York City. I had been picked up for prostitution several times in New York City. And the police officers are horrible, absolutely horrible to the working girls. They don't treat you like you're human, you know, and also you're afraid. You're also afraid to turn on your pimp at the same time. You're afraid of the repercussions of the consequences of the street. And, you know, and going forward, also, I have to mention, I suffered such severe depression and anxiety. I was constantly suicidal. And I thought that's the only way I was going to get out, was he was going to kill me or I was going to kill myself.
Adam, can you just, before I grab our first phone call, just kind of characterize the conversations you've had with law enforcement again about the importance of this change of culture that we have in not treating sex trafficking and human trafficking victims as criminals themselves.
Yeah, and I think that is changing within the law enforcement community. Obviously, it would help if the community at large would understand this. At the same time, talking with Tiffany Lee, one of the attorneys within the U.S. Attorney's Office, she clearly gets it. She helped teach me a lot about it. So here's someone from the law enforcement side. And it's just a matter of some of these women finding someone who has that sensitive ear and can notice the signs. Maybe they received particular training in this, or they just have common sense and they can understand what's happening.
Who was do you remember, Caitlin, the youngest girl who came to work with Kenneth White? Do you remember, what was the age range?
Between 22 and 30.
So you were the youngest at the time, right? You were 19?
Correct.
When he picked you up?
Correct. 19, about to be 20.
Okay.
And I was the youngest, and I was convinced there was one girl who was there who was lying about her age. And it turned out she was a minor. She was claiming she was 18, and I think she was actually about 16.
There are many documented cases of people like Kenneth White who traffic in girls as young as 13, 14, 15. It certainly does happen. Let's take our only break of the hour. We'll come back. I know Tom in Greece is on the phone and has a question for Caitlin. And listeners, if you have questions, we can take some of those. I want to be sensitive here, but I know that you will be with Caitlin, who's just telling her remarkable story. And I know it's tough to hear this, but we're also going to talk about the remarkable success that she's having in her life and hopefully the inspiration that she will provide to other people who might be hearing us today who need that inspiration. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're right back after this break. Coming up in our second hour, what do we really know about the food we put into our bodies? What do we base it on? How do we define nutritionism and holism? One of the people who uses those terms to great effect is Colin Campbell, the co-author of the 2005 China study that helped move veganism into the American mainstream. He's giving a sold-out presentation, but no worries, he's got time for us next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guests include Caitlin, who is a woman from Western New York, and she is a human trafficking survivor telling her remarkable story in the hopes that it will help our community better understand what is happening here and maybe even save lives. And her story was first brought to our community a couple of weeks ago by Adam Chodak, WROC-TV anchor and managing editor, who spent months covering this story and putting these reports together, not only talking to Caitlin, but another trafficking survivor named Stephanie, who was trafficked by the same man, Kenneth White. You can see Adam's reporting on these stories, and Megan Mack, producer, and I have linked to them on our Twitter accounts, and you ought to check them out when you get a chance to do that. Adam, there's a number that you want to share for people in our community to understand. What's the number?
Right. So it's for the Worker Justice Center. It's 585-325-3050. This is for anyone who is a victim, but also if you sense that someone is a victim, because unlike periods in Caitlin's life, there are survivors, there are victims in this case who do have some connection to their family. And so if their family can help in any way, you can get resources there. If you're in the Buffalo area, the International Institute of Buffalo is extremely helpful and can really direct a ton of resources your way.
Okay, do the number again one more time.
All right, here it is. 585-325-3050.
All right, let me get our first phone call, and this is Tom in Greece. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello. Good conversation, good show. I wanted to make a very brief comment. When she was talking, Caitlin was talking about her introduction to prostitution, how she met this man, it sounded like, it reminded me of that movie Pretty Woman, which was criticized for being sort of a fairy tale Cinderella version of a prostitute's life. But I wanted to ask about the these newspaper ads that she said were put into newspapers like the Village Voice. What was the wording? I mean, they couldn't run ads for prostitutes. Were these like personal ads, or were they like escort services, or what were they? And I'll take my response off the air.
All right, Tom, first of all, this is not a Pretty Woman story here. I mean, Pretty Woman, first of all, is fiction, you're right. Second of all, it had a fairy tale ending, you're right. And third, you know, there's a debate in libertarian and societal circles about whether prostitution should be legal or not. Human trafficking is when it's essentially, well, let's listen to what Tiffany Lee had to say about it, U.S. attorney. Adam Chodak talked to the U.S. attorney about this, and her description of this is not prostitution. This is, let's listen to what the U.S. attorney had to say.
Human trafficking is modern-day slavery. In our district, for the last 3 years, we have had over 30 cases. So the situation is more prevalent, I think, than the public understands.
Modern day slavery. So let's just not lose sight of this. This is not a case of, you know, should prostitution be legal or not? This is modern day slavery. As for how they know about it, Tom is curious to know, Caitlin, you know, when you were being controlled by Kenneth White for all those years, how did people find his services? How did that happen?
Well, escorting is not illegal. Spending money with a woman for her time. And the disclaimer would be whatever we do in that time is between two consenting adults. Unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, you're not really consenting.
Okay. And I only ask this question to try to make sure I understand the picture as best we can, not for any prurient reasons, but the people who you were with, did they show any respect for you? You know, was it occasionally violent? Do you remember what that was like?
It was. There were gentlemen that, and I appreciated those men in that time of my life, if somebody showed up and was respectful, and sometimes it made you feel good. They would be extremely complimentary towards you and bring you gifts. You know, I've received everything from a bass guitar to opera tickets, like, you know, just here's an extra tip for you. And it's crazy. And then there are gentlemen who come in who are just coming in to fulfill their own sick fantasies. And that would range from anything from domination, which actually I enjoyed because then I got to take my aggression and anger out on somebody. And but that's how sick I was at the time. And there were gentlemen who would come in and just be awful, treat you like, you know, I've paid for you, so I can do what I want with you. Mm. And it would be constantly trying to stand up for my own, you know, rights as just a human being sometimes, where you're not going to treat me like that. You're not going to talk to me like that. And I've seen both from both sides of the coin.
It was multiple men a night, right?
Absolutely.
Usually two, one in one session and one in another, or was it more than that?
how many clients I'd taken a night.
Yeah.
It could have been as many as 10 to 20.
Oh, wow.
No, one is how many hours are there in a day, you know?
Okay. And were you scared going to, quote unquote, going to work?
I was, and that's where the alcohol comes in to play. I would use it to dull my senses and kind of give you that liquid courage that some people talk about. Alcohol has that effect on you. And then actually I ended up getting sober, thank God. And then everything became much more real.
Nicole in Rochester writes and says, first, I want to thank Caitlin for sharing her story. Hearing this is heartbreaking, and I'm so glad you're speaking out about this to educate the population on this issue. And she says, I work with survivors of sexual violence, and I wanted to ask the question of what are some signs someone can look for? Since this is an issue in Rochester, I think it would be beneficial to know what the signs are to look for. What would you say that to that?
It depends on the signs. If it's a sign of a woman who's doing this, having multiple cell phones, carrying around large sums of cash, very cloaked in being discreet about talking about themselves, you know, especially what they do for work. Some girls like myself, I had a whole backstory, a whole lie to tell my family because obviously I was ashamed. So I began to sporadically see my family and they thought that Kenneth White was my boyfriend and that he was in real estate and I am just a kept woman at home. And, it's so hard to pinpoint that question about what to look for, because they can come off completely, absolutely normal unless you know someone in their, you know, intimate details of their day-to-day life. It's hard to know. Most girls, whereas they will be kind of not very forthcoming around their family, they might be more so around making friends. But then again, you're isolated, so you really don't have any friends. So where, you know, that's such a hard question to pinpoint.
What scares me is that people like Kenneth White get very good at hiding girls and young women and understanding how to control them. So, Nicole, it's a great question, but oof, boy, oh boy. Let me grab one more phone call, and then we're going to talk about how Kenneth White's story ended up moving with him convicted and Caitlin's remarkable success story. But before we get there, let's get Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
I just wanted to ask her, did she ever seek the covering of churches? And if so, how did they respond to her? Were they receptive in trying to help you, or were they trying to push you aside? I need to know this for myself, because they should have responded to you in a positive way, and they should have reached out to you and tried to help you all they could.
Reverend, thank you. Sam's a local reverend, and I know this is very important to him to hear if the church community responded appropriately. What would you say?
Actually, I belong to a wonderful church now. I never sought out the help of churches before. Mm-hmm. I've always been a very spiritual person, and God is really what I feel has taken me through this and kept me alive all these years, actually. But when I was indicted, I sought the comfort and support of my pastor at my church, and I did have a huge support system behind me with that church. I was baptized actually, and my story was told at the church, and everyone there has been very Christian-like in what the meaning of the word Christian means, you know, and been absolutely wonderful and very supportive of me.
Well, eventually things changed for Caitlin, and in Adam Chodak's piece, the other woman who he interviewed, Stephanie, said, with Kenneth White, I wasn't allowed to eat, I wasn't allowed to sleep, and day in, day out, if someone called, it was like, let's go. Was that the same for you? Were you allowed to eat and sleep? I mean, you know, did you work, quote unquote, work every single day? Were there days off?
I never had a day off.
No days off.
No days off. No matter what time of the month it is, if you can't catch my drift. What would happen was he would come and take money, and then if you're hungry, you better make some more money so you can go eat. That's how he would always constantly keep you drained, so to speak. So I would tuck $20 away so I could make sure I would have enough alcohol. That's where, like I said before, earlier, my obsession was with my alcoholism. Mm-hmm. It took about 6 years for it to really spiral down to the point where even he didn't want to deal with me anymore, because sober Caitlin makes money. Drunk Caitlin passes out and misses all the phone calls. Hmm.
So what happened here? You were trafficked for the better part of 8 years, but what happened to Kenneth White and how did things change?
things finally changed where he was indicted. And I had actually heard from a girl I was friends with who had left, and we were still friends on social media, saying the FBI is asking about you. And I had been sober for a better part of a year and still struggling with how am I going to deal with this. I had actually went to rehab, sought counseling, and I started trauma counseling. And I did EMDR therapy. But I always felt like I was living a double life, and I couldn't be fully honest and really tell people because you're scared. After 8 years, you kind of get in this mindset of, you know, there's going to be no way out of this. It really, you feel very hopeless.
Had you talked to your family at all?
No. I was ashamed.
To you, to them, were you a missing person? What were you?
I wasn't a missing person because I would be allowed to come home once in a while. I would cry because I would want to go home, and he would say, you have to make so much money before you can go home and see your family.
And so you would go home, but did you tell them where you were coming from and what you were doing?
My mother knew, and I'll just disclaimer head on. Early on in this, I tried to come home, and my mom got frustrated with me not being able to stay sober, and she actually said, I know she probably regrets this to this day. She said, I'm going to bring you back to your pimp. And she drove me back to the hotel and dropped me off. Mm.
Okay, so your friend who had been telling you that the FBI is kind of wanting to talk to you, mm-hmm. That's how you found out that Kenneth White was being picked up by the authorities?
Well, that happened later in the week. Actually, what happened was I was sober in a 12-step group, mm-hmm. and a good friend of mine in that group just so happens to be an ex-federal judge, Terry Newcomb, and he's very open about everything, and he volunteered as my lawyer, as a public defender, but he was very good. And I asked him, he was friends with the U.S. District Attorney, Jack Rogowski, and I said, well, can you see what they want? And I was thinking, maybe this is it coming to an end. Maybe this is it. And I was finally willing to talk to the FBI. Well, what happened was he went and asked them, you know, about why they were inquiring about me and whatnot. And they indicted me the next day.
Indicted you?
Me. They indicted me. And when Terry, my attorney, called me back and said, well, I have some news. You and Kenny have both been indicted. And they picked him up this morning, and there's a warrant for your arrest. He said, but I was able to work it out so you can go turn yourself in tomorrow.
What were you thinking at that time?
I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. I literally dropped to my knees, and it felt like I had been shot in the chest. I didn't understand why, when it was apparent to all the other girls in the statements they made leading up to the indictment, there was one common factor that I was also a victim, that I was beaten the worst, that I was treated the worst. The reports talked about what items he had beat me with, and I couldn't wrap my head around why are they indicting me, because I had been there since day one, and because there was points where he had me drive girls, so the second you drive somebody over state lines, because he would have us go together in a car or whatever, then you are automatically a sex trafficker by the federal definition.
And so what happened to you?
I went and turned myself in and was released on a $15,000 signature bond. And I didn't drink. That was the first thought in my head was, what am I going to do? And I was talking to Adam earlier about how I remain sober in my day-to-day life. And that's constantly doing the next right thing, focusing on my recovery. And so that's the only thing I could focus on doing was the next right thing. I moved in with a member of the 12-step group. A woman let me move in with her. I got a job waitressing because that was the only job I could get, without them looking at my background as in the restaurant industry. And, I worked my butt off until I had enough money for an apartment. And I will say the only reason I was too scared to go back to prostitution, one, because obviously if I was arrested, I would be, my bail would be revoked and I would do anything for my freedom at this point. I felt like the government was trying to control me. But it worked out for the best because that little push, and then I was in counseling, and I told my counselor, finally, everything finally came out. And that was the most freeing moment of my life. So at the same time, as horrible as it was, obviously I'm a free woman sitting here talking to you. It was one of the best things that happened to me in my life, as strange as that sounds. I'm grateful. because, I mean, obviously they could have just indicted him on his own, but the way it turned out is a miracle, nothing short of a miracle.
And Adam, what happened to Kenneth White?
So he is in prison now for 13 years. I believe he served two or three of those years already. It was 2013. And he's going to be there for a while. It's not nearly as long as many other sex traffickers. You have Thomas Kramer. He got a 30-year sentence. There's a 10-year minimum, which he asked for in court at his sentencing. And he got 30 years. And when he made his plea, I think Caitlin would find this interesting. I don't know if you know this. They had put him in the section of the prison with pedophiles. And he told the judge, why am I there? I'm not like them. Like, yes, my compass is not north, but I'm not like them. But that's where he is right now, and he will forever be labeled a sex offender.
But 13 years is the sentence. And for you, Caitlin, you know, have you thought about a time in the future when Kenneth White is not incarcerated anymore?
I feel like for me in that time, that's when justice for me is over. Then 13 years, you know, I recently attended a conference in Washington, D.C. about, and the topic, one of the topics on the panel I spoke on is victims who are treated as perpetrators. And I'm so excited to start a dialogue about this because there is that stigma that even though you're breaking laws, because not only with prostitution, there comes a lot of other misdemeanors and felonies that happen because of the prostitution, assaults, robberies, etc. And I'm excited to, even though you may be forced, I'm excited to start this dialogue about, because there are women who were charged with the same thing I was charged with, and they are doing years and years in federal penitentiaries.
I have to tell you that when Adam was working on this piece and had a chance to talk to him about what he was working on, he said, when you meet Caitlin, I mean, these women, Caitlin and Stephanie, are amazing. He said, Caitlin's going to be CEO. She's an amazing woman when you understand her strength and what she has been able to do. So the snapshot of your life now is quite different. You seem to be doing really well.
Absolutely. I wish the viewers could see the smile on my face right now when I talk about it, because it's nothing short of a miracle. First things first, stay sober, help others. And that's what I've been doing in my day-to-day life. It actually, I got hooked up with the International Institute of Buffalo because the FBI agents who prosecuted me, I'm actually friends with them now. And they're wonderful women, and they did not want to prosecute me. The U.S. District Attorney did not want to prosecute me. It came from higher-ups, from William Hochul, who is now retired. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the court was scratching their head. The judge was wonderful, and I was on a pretrial investigation for 2 years. And actually, in that 2 years, I met my husband of today. Actually, I will say this. Today is our one-year wedding anniversary today. So shout out. I love you.
By the way, I did not know I was inviting Caitlin on her 1 year wedding anniversary, and there's no way I would have agreed to this, but you said, you know, you've got a great husband and he's totally cool with it.
He is my number one supporter. He is a kind, understanding man because some people would think, well, who would be with an ex-prostitute? And that's not the case at all. Cause we met through our common bonds of, sobriety, and, we were friends first for about a year or two. And that before anything romantic sparked up. And we got engaged 2 years ago. And I didn't know if I was going to be having a wedding or be going to jail. Honestly, because my sentencing date was June 7th, a week before my birthday. And what ended up happening was I worked two jobs, waitressing. And then I went back to school and cut it back to one job. Where in the last 2 years I've been getting my CASAC, which is a substance abuse counselor. And then I woke up last week and I said, I think I want to go to law school. And seriously, you know, like a legally amazing blonde moment. but yeah, 4.0 GPA. I've been accepted to the master's program at the University of Buffalo for social work.
That's wonderful.
Where I'm hoping I can take my experience, strength, and hope and move that forward to help other victims. I volunteer at a women's halfway house in Buffalo to take meetings there. And this is where it all came about for working with other victims have approached themselves to me from hearing my story.
Caitlin, that's amazing. And I think you're going to inspire people. I'm so impressed with your strength, and I'm just so grateful that you came in here to share this. I can't thank you enough. And I hope I talk to you again down the line, and it's just more wonderful news like this. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Tell your husband sorry about that.
I will. It's okay. He's at home with our new baby.
Caitlin is a human trafficking survivor and a great success story, doing wonderful work in our community. Adam Chodak brought her story and others to our community earlier this month. Thank you for doing that. Nice to see you.
Of course, real quick, just want to say, Stephanie, if you are listening, you were incredibly strong and tender, and thank you so much for helping me share this story. And of course, I've thanked Caitlin 1,000 times as well.
You got it. Thanks to both of you. Let's get a short break. More Connections is next.